It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Ahead of the NFL draft next month in Green Bay, the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling meets today and tomorrow in Onalaska for its annual conference.
The American Gaming Association says gambling revenue is near all-time highs, driven largely by increases in sports betting.
And the risk of gambling addiction has been on the rise since the Supreme Court legalized sports books 7 years ago. That according to the National Council on Problem Gambling.
But help is available around the clock for those struggling with gambling and the people who care about them.
For more on the growing concerns and the state's resources, we're joined by Rose Blazinski, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. Rose, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And to start, how can folks connect with help right now who have concerns about gambling? What's the best place to go?
The best place to start is to call us at our toll-free gambling helpline at 1-800-426-2535. And we can take you from there with getting resources in your community and other things as well.
That's 1-800-426-2535. And we'll have a link up at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. Are you seeing a change in the trends of people who are reaching out to seek help in Wisconsin, Rose?
In some ways we are. You know, we certainly are seeing more sports gamblers. We're hearing about more sports gamblers. So we know that when you increase accessibility somewhere with the different types of gambling, you can certainly increase the number of people who are going to have that problem.
Where is sports gambling legal in Wisconsin today?
They do have sports rooms at a couple of the different casinos. And then, you know, other than that, people find a way. You could take away all the legal gambling and they'll still find a way to do it. So,
is that because of the apps that are available on the phone and the growing number of sports books that are advertised during any number of sporting events?
Absolutely. Again, it's that accessibility thing. It's all over the internet. You know, you could be sitting next to me gambling and I would never know because it's so easy to access.
And so how new and recent is this, and what does this mean for the people with struggles with gambling today?
Well, the sports betting has become much more prominent in the last couple of years. And I think, you know, a lot of states do have legalized sports betting and that will continue to grow. You know, we're not seeing huge amounts with that, but we certainly talk with people as well that have, you know, they might do casino gambling, they might, you know, cards, poker, all different types of things.
What does problem gambling look like, Rose?
It looks like a social gambler can set a certain amount of money in a certain amount of time, and that's all they ever do. They never go past their $20 or whatever. A problem to pathological gambler is somebody who is spending more money than they used to. They're spending more time gambling. It might be affecting their family. It might be affecting their work, borrowing money, bankruptcies. 65% of gamblers, it's estimated, commit some kind of a crime to feed their gambling habit. The thing with a gambling problem is, it's really easy to hide because there's nothing ingested. You know, it's not like a drug or alcohol problem. So it can get to some pretty extreme bottoms before people start figuring it out that somebody might have a gambling problem.
Well, somebody who has an addiction may be the last one around them to identify that they have this problem. So what kind of checklist or resources are available to see whether or not you're a social gambler or a problem gambler?
Well, if you go onto our website, which is wi-problemgamblers.com, there's a great place to start, and it's the Gamblers Anonymous 20 Questions. And that's a self-test that you can take, and it'll tell you if you score so many yeses, you might want to reach further for help for your gambling problem. There's a lot of other things on the website as well that can kind of give you some direction. You know, for a family member, if you're seeing somebody who's all of a sudden interested in sports and in the past they could have cared less, that could be a warning sign. Or you're seeing evidence of sports type things. Or, you know, a casino gambler, sometimes they will they'll disappear for hours and hours on end. You know, things that are just out of the normal habits you want to pay attention to. Again, family who's having money issues and has never had money issues, you want to look what's going on here.
Rose Blazinski, our guest, executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling, hosting their 26th annual conference today and tomorrow in Onalaska. And Rose, what are some of the stories, common stories that you hear that strike a chord with you?
Oh, there's lots of them over the last 27 years. But certainly, I think the ones that obviously tug dearest is, you know, when it's affecting a whole family, you know, because of the fact that people lose so much money. Certainly our biggest concern, and one again that's touches my heart, is people can become very suicidal with gambling addiction. Suicide is much more prevalent in gambling addiction than in other addictions. So, you know, I'll give you an example. Obviously some facts have been changed, but you know, a person's calling, and one I remember from way back is the wife had like 25 credit cards and they were all maxed out. And the husband was just getting like, oh, something's not right here. And the devastation that I remember hearing in his voice, some of those things, they just really stick with you, that people sometimes think gambling addiction is not serious or it's funny. And it isn't, because it can rip apart whole families.
So what does the road to recovery look like for problem gamblers?
I think the most important thing is to make that first call. We also have a chat line or a text line. Get some information. If you're the gambler yourself, we have Gamblers Anonymous meetings. We have treatment providers that have been trained to deal specifically with the gambling addiction. So those are really good places to start. And there, you know, we have other information depending upon what your needs might be. We can point you in other directions. With the helpline, our goal is to make sure there's nothing suicidal going on, making sure you're kind of past that initial crisis. And then our goal is to connect you with those long-term resources.
Rose, I see on your website you have other resources available, and we talked about the readily available apps for gambling that you can put on your phone, but you have tools just as well for dealing with problem gambling, don't you?
Yes, we have all kinds of, like I said, there's a couple screening tools in addition to the GA meeting. There's some information if you're a family member, talks about how you can talk to your family member who may have a gambling problem. There's a lot of information on there. It's a great place to start.
Today's and tomorrow's conference, the focus is on awareness, education, and prevention. How can we best prevent problem gambling?
I think the best way is to be aware that it is and can be an addiction, that it can happen to absolutely anybody, and to know that resources are there for you. I think it's really important to know what the warning signs are in yourself or in someone else, so you can, you know, give them some information as well. Awareness and education is the best thing you can start with.
And when you're dealing with addiction, sometimes people say you have to hit bottom before you can begin the road to recovery. Is there ways to stop it before we get that far?
Well, you know, I tell people to kind of pay attention, kind of the first warning sign. If you've always spent $50, whatever, betting on the Packers or going to the casino or whatever gambling you do, and you've always been satisfied with that, and all of a sudden tonight I'm like, oh, I'm just going to go get another 50 bucks and I'm going to place another bet, or I'm going to, you know, play another game. That's the very first warning sign that you're starting to cross over from being a social, fun activity to maybe having some kind of a problem.
What are some of the big gambling fallacies that could bring people to a problem?
Well, people think they're going to get rich, and that's not going to happen. It looks real easy. Oh, if I just, because most gamblers have an initial big win, and that is what gets you hooked. Because nothing's being ingested, we again think, oh, how could you be addicted to that? I'm not taking anything. But the same types of things happen in your brain that they do with other addictions.
The serotonin, the rush, that feeling that you get when you win big, but also that feeling you get when you lose and think that the next time around you may come up big.
Absolutely. The next big win is right around the corner. Yeah. And you know, that's the hardest thing to convince a problem gambler that it isn't, because even if they win, they always go back to chase those wins, chase their losses.
Rose, this is the 26th annual conference today. You say you've been doing this for 27 years. What brought you to this work?
Totally accidentally. My sister called me up and said she found the perfect job for me in the newspaper. And here I am. And I've been very, very blessed to find a job that I like 99.9% of the time. It's just been a wonderful challenge along the way. And I've met some wonderful, wonderful people. I've met some gamblers that have been now in recovery for 20 some years. So it's been really, I fell where I was supposed to fall, I guess. So,
Will your organization have a presence at the NFL draft?
Not that I'm aware of, so probably not.
I want to ask you about loot boxes and video games, and whether or not we are seeing gambling targeted to kids when they play video games and there is that same serotonin rush of the big win that they can find in video games.
Yeah, there definitely is a connection there. The thing that we see is the earlier the kids start doing those things, especially once you get into high school, you might start playing poker with your friends, those things. We know that the earlier you start gambling, the higher your risk is of becoming addicted to gambling.
Rose, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Rose Blazinski is executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. She joined us as their 26th annual conference gets underway today in Onalaska. The focus this year is on gambling awareness, education, and prevention. If you or someone you know needs help, the helpline is available 24/7 anytime you need it. 1-800-426-2535. That's 1-800-426-2535. And to connect with resources and help with gambling concerns, you'll also find a link on today's show page at wpr.org/WisconsinToday.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the town of Campbell has battled toxic PFAS chemicals for years, and now the town is drilling a municipal water system.
We feel that the best option for us is to go into a separate aquifer that is 100% PFAS-free.
One community's journey to clean drinking water, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Lee Rayburn. Governor Tony Evers' new two-year budget plan calls for nearly $150 million to address PFAS contamination. It's the latest step in years of state government efforts to deal with toxic forever chemicals in the environment and drinking water.
PFAS are a group of more than 15,000 types of chemicals that are slow to break down. And according to the Environmental Protection Agency, exposure to certain levels of PFAS has been linked to developmental delays in children and a rise in some cancers, among other health effects.
In recent years, Evers and Republican lawmakers have clashed over how to clean up PFAS, with a $125 million fund set aside in the last budget going unused as the parties argue over provisions for spending the money and regulatory authority.
To learn more about the science of detecting and destroying forever chemicals, we're joined by Gavin Dehnert, an emerging contaminant scientist with Wisconsin Sea Grant and UW-Madison. Gavin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thank you for having me and excited to talk a little bit about PFAS.
Yes, Governor Evers' new two-year budget proposal calls for over $145 million to address this pollution. What are some ways that communities can address PFAS contamination in their drinking water?
I think the first question that we're all kind of asking right now is, do we have PFAS in our water? So one of the first kind of big ways that we can do this is actually going out and testing for PFAS, whether that be in our private wells or in municipalities. But kind of the first step to this is actually testing to see what levels we do or potentially don't have.
And testing can be costly. I mean, we're looking at Governor Evers' budget, and he's setting aside a proposed grant program where the bulk of the funding goes to test municipal water systems. Why is it so costly?
So the first idea behind this is, you know, the original tests for PFAS, where we could actually only look for about 16 analytes, they could run anywhere from, you know, $500 to $600 for a single test. So it is quite expensive. Now we are able to test for more PFAS. We are kind of up to about 40 analytes right now. Those prices have gone down, but they still do run about, you know, $350 to $400 for a test. So it is quite expensive to test for PFAS. And part of the reason behind that is we are able to test at extremely low levels. So there's a lot of people power that go into preparing the samples so we can detect them at such low levels.
Where do you get the samples from usually?
You can get water samples, whether they be from surface water, if your drinking water is coming from surface water, or if it's coming from groundwater. If it's a private well, we can actually grab water samples directly from an outside source or potentially even from inside the house. But for like a municipality, they will have a kind of a water source for us to analyze.
And how accurate are these tests? Do you feel like they're very confident in the results?
These tests are very, very good at detecting levels that are extremely low. So we can actually measure down to what we call nanograms per liter or parts per trillion. And these are accurate all the way down to, depending on the analyte, a single nanogram per liter. And they have the ability to tell us, you know, whether or not it was 1 nanogram versus 2 nanograms per liter. So very, very high accuracy in telling us that information.
I've always wondered if scientists have the ability to make PFAS, nearly 15,000 of these synthetic chemicals and counting, and that's from the EPA estimates. Why can't scientists also have the ability to destroy them and break them down, make them inert?
Yeah. So that's part of the beauty and the problem with PFAS themselves. So what makes a PFAS is they have a carbon to fluorine bond, and that is one of the strongest organic bonds that is known to exist. So it takes a lot of energy for us to actually break that bond. And that's the reason these PFAS chemicals have been labeled as forever chemicals, because once they're created, they can have very long half-lives. Or what I mean by that is it takes a very, very long time for them to break down. And that's due to that, how strong that carbon to fluorine bond is.
What unanswered questions then do scientists have around the scope of our state's issues with PFAS? What don't you know now?
So I like to always say is we know less than what we don't know, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. So when I give a lot of talks about PFAS, we get a lot of questions about, you know, where are PFAS? How long do some of these different PFAS last? What do these PFAS break down into? And we have a lot more of my answers end up being, well, we don't know that yet. And that's partially due to this fact that the PFAS have, you know, kind of really hit the scientific radar, let's say, in the last 7 to 5 years. Now, they've been around for a lot longer, right? Kind of created back in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. But a lot of the research around these PFAS has really been done in the last, 6 to 10 years.
I understand that you're involved in a new project that would aim to track PFAS contamination in water in areas known to have higher levels. Is treating PFAS in drinking water somewhat limited in the effectiveness if other bodies of water throughout the state contain high levels of these chemicals? How does it cycle through the environment?
So PFAS can get into our environment a lot of different ways, and it can, you know, easily get into our rivers or our drinking water, groundwater, because it is very soluble. So some of them can actually move far distances. Some of the short chain PFAS can move, you know, quite a ways, where some of the long ones might move slower or less distance. But majority of the issue about PFAS is it gets into our drinking water, it gets into our surface water, it can be in our soils, it can also be transmitted through the air. So we can kind of think right now is, you know, some of these PFAS are actually ubiquitous or kind of all over the environment. So when we're thinking about trying to treat a single area for PFAS contamination, we might be missing potential sources that could be coming in the future.
And you have to protect the sources that are still clean, I would imagine. I mean, with the town of Campbell trying to tap an aquifer that seems to, at the moment, be not penetrating with PFAS, how would you approach that in terms of making sure that that source of clean water stays clean?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. And the hardest part about PFAS is because it does last so long, and, you know, different types of these PFAS, you know, they move through the environment at different rates. It's important for us to know what those concentrations are and let, as you just mentioned, an untapped or a quote unquote clean source, and to be able to monitor that to ensure that it's not being contaminated later on through a source that already exists. So there's a little bit of this idea of continuing monitoring to make sure that we are protecting what is clean, as well as remediating the areas that we do know that have high levels of PFAS.
Oh, continued monitoring then. So if you're testing a municipal water system, you would want to get on a schedule to continually test it to make sure that it is still safe?
Yeah, so I like to kind of say is the first issue with PFAS, right, is just do we know if it's there, as I kind of had already hinted at. So if we can continually monitor, you know, what the levels of PFAS are, that can give us a really good indication of if that source is being continuously contaminated or potentially being contaminated by a new source or something like that.
The work that you're talking about takes scientists, takes a group of scientists. It takes researchers at universities as well, everyone working together. We're seeing what's happening at the federal level with the Trump administration set to lay off 10% of NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's workforce. And that's according to latest estimates by the Associated Press. What impact could cuts have in addressing PFAS pollution?
That's a really, really interesting question to think about. And so PFAS are not just a single issue, right? We're talking a little bit about PFAS in our groundwater, but, you know, it's in a whole bunch of different areas. And so if we are going to be limiting the ability for us to do research on it or the science behind it, that could have some huge impacts moving forward. And in particular, right, we think a lot of this stuff as, you know, a single issue. So for something like impacts on humans, but if we take more of this one health approach and kind of like, how is this impacting the environment? How is this impacting our, you know, humans? How is this impacting the wildlife? And it takes all of these different scientists to kind of come together to try to answer all of these questions together. So it's going to take a lot of the research scientists and a lot of, you know, collaborative thinking as we kind of move forward. So I think it's very essential that we, you know, have a large group of people that are looking at this from a lot of different angles.
Gavin, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Gavin Dehnert is an emerging contaminant scientist with Wisconsin Sea Grant and UW-Madison. Now we hear from a community along the Mississippi River. Residents of French Island in La Crosse County have been relying on bottled water and fighting PFAS contamination for 5 years. Lee Donahue is the Town of Campbell's Health, Education, and Welfare Supervisor. Lee, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
When we last talked in June, the town of Campbell was exploring the Mount Simon Aquifer that could serve as a potential source for clean water for the town. Has this turned into a solution?
Well, it's well on its way. We are very excited to announce that we will be drilling our first municipal well within the next month, and that will begin our municipal water system so that we will be able to have safe long-term water for all Campbell residents. It's really an exciting time.
What does that feel like for you?
Ooh, it's so exciting. To see that this is actually happening after all of these years. But I think we needed the time to explore what the options were going to be, what the most cost-efficient option was going to be for our residents, and what was going to provide us with the safest source of water. So Campbell will be the only municipality in our region, other than La Crescent, Minnesota, that taps into this much deeper Mount Simon Aquifer. So Mount Simon Aquifer has been used in La Crescent for roughly 2+ decades. And so it will be really, really exciting to eventually be able to turn on our taps again and safely drink what comes out.
Eventually, because drilling is one thing, but when would municipal water be up and running?
We are pushing for our system to be up and running at the end of 2027. And I know that seems like a long time away, but compared to where we were in October of 2020, people are going to see this within their lifetime. And that was a question that many people asked all along, right? How long is this going to take? And will I ever see it come to fruition?
Can you touch on affordability? Is this affordable for local residents, for residents of French Island?
That has been one of our priorities, to make certain that it is affordable. So we use a variety of different funding sources through the state and through the federal government, much of which has already been awarded, so that it will be affordable for our residents.
Why is drilling this well the right solution for the PFAS problem?
Well, it will provide the safest source of water, right? We have neighboring communities that are also beginning to find PFAS in their water supplies. It doesn't make sense to connect to somebody who has the same problem that we do. We feel that the best option for us is to go into a separate aquifer that is 100% PFAS-free.
And you're also looking to reconfigure the town in a way. Last fall, close to 900 people in the town of Campbell signed a petition to have the town be incorporated as a village. Why is this an important step, and how is it connected to PFAS?
Well, in some ways, it is and it isn't.
Okay.
Most importantly, if we become a village, or I'm going to say when we become a village, it maintains Campbell's independence. We've been an independent municipality for almost 200 years, and it seals our borders from annexation, which is very important. It also preserves all of our high-performing services. We have our own police department, our own fire department. We do our own zoning, and we really want to keep our affordable tax rate, and also to preserve our heritage.
And so would you be the village of Campbell, or would you be the village of French Island?
Well, we've talked about becoming the village of French Island. When you say Campbell, most people think soup. They don't think Sipality. And so, you know, when you talk to someone who lives here, they will always say, I live in French Island. And we think that becoming the village of French Island is going to be a spectacular achievement.
Is dealing with PFAS contamination a one-size solution for communities? And by that, is what French Island is going through the steps, similar steps that Peshtigo or Wausau or another community battling PFAS would arrive to a similar solution?
No, it's not. That's the one insidious thing about PFAS, is that everybody's circumstances are different. the hydrogeologic features of where they live are different. You know, my compatriots up in Peshtigo have been fighting this even longer than we have, for more than 8 years. And I was just told the other day that Hale's Corner is now experiencing some PFAS issues as well. So our solution isn't necessarily a template for other communities. However, the research that we are doing with UW-Madison, USGS, and Wisconsin Geological Survey will help serve as a template for the DNR to be able to look at how PFAS plumes move in a variety of geologic areas, and to see how fast plumes are moving and the directions that they move. And hopefully that information will help provide those other communities with additional information so they can figure out what their long-term solution is going to be.
Lee, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Lee Donahue is the Town of Campbell's Health, Education, and Welfare Supervisor. The town is preparing to drill a municipal well in the coming weeks, and this will enable private well owners to have access to tap water that doesn't contain harmful PFAS chemicals. Earlier, we spoke with Gavin Dehnert, who is an emerging contaminants scientist with Wisconsin Sea Grant and UW-Madison.
We've been learning about the latest ways that Wisconsin is addressing the problems with PFAS contamination in drinking water, and we want to hear from you. What is the drinking water quality like in your area? Has your community found PFAS in the water supply? And what questions or concerns do you have about your tap water?
You can leave a voicemail or text us with your comments at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232, or you can email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a retired couple who live on French Island open up their home. They show us how they use bottled water due to years of toxic PFAS contamination in their well water.
We go to make a cup of coffee or get a drink of water, we go right over to the sink and go, ugh.
Living without the tap, that's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Lee Rayburn. Now to a personal story about how toxic PFAS contamination is affecting a retired couple who lives on French Island, a few miles north of La Crosse.
Jim Boyson and Margie Walker have lived in their home for over 45 years. In late 2020, they learned their well was contaminated and they wouldn't be able to safely drink their tap water.
So they stopped cooking with it.
They stopped brushing their teeth using the tap.
And they stopped tending a garden.
Jim is a retired trucker and plumber who enjoyed fishing before he learned about widespread PFAS in his community. Margie, his wife, says their kitchen sink became famous after appearing in so many news stories about the PFAS crisis.
While a new public well is on the way in the town of Campbell, Jim and Margie are waiting for the day when they can safely drink from their tap again.
WPR producer Rochelle Wilson visited their home and brings us their story.
For one thing, if you need dates or anything, you have to get them from her. But how long ago was it?
I think it was 2020 when we first heard about it. Because this is into the fifth year now, yeah, or something like that.
That's Jim Boyson and Margie Walker. They moved into their house on French Island in 1979, just after they got married. They looked forward to raising their family and growing old together here. But more than 4 years ago, they learned that their well water was contaminated by PFAS. Ever since then, they've been using jugs and bottles of water delivered to them every week.
That's our water storage right here. Now I can't keep nothing in there because it's all full of water. So I got my boots in the kitchen now.
Looking back, Jim and Margie say the first sign of trouble was in 2001, when there was a plane crash at the airport just blocks from their home. Firefighters put out the blaze with foam containing PFAS.
The wells are contaminated with PFAS, the man-made compounds were used to produce the firefighting foam sprayed at the La Crosse Airport for decades.
I heard it crash. I ran down the block and looked, and they were spraying the foam on it already, and knowing that there was two people in there, too.
Well, the accident happened in 2001. So we're thinking that we went another 20 years not knowing that we were drinking the contaminated water. And then when we finally found out, it was probably 2020 or 2021.
But they were doing it long before we got here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we used to see black smoke coming from the back of the airport all the time. And that was them practicing spraying PFAS foam all over the fires that they set. This PFAS issue got to bothering us so much because so many people, we weren't aware of what was going on out there, that it was that dangerous. But when we found out, that's when we really started worrying a lot about it. I went on the computer on Google and wrote down the question, where does PFAS go when you wash your dishes and you dry them? Or where does PFAS go when you wipe something off and you put the cloth somewhere else? And if it's always there and you can't get rid of it, if it's on your clothes, you're washing it down the drain. It's going into the river or wherever. And after I asked that question on Google, they just said somewhere else. That's where it goes. You know, if you take water with you somewhere else, like in your boat or anywhere, and you dump that water, you're spreading PFAS around. You know, how do you get rid of it? You can't water your lawn because it would go down through the ground into your well, right back where you got it from. So you're pretty much at the will of the PFAS, actually. Our kids all drank it. Our company all drank it. We used to have parties over here. They all drank it. We've been drinking it that long. I've got thyroid problems, probably from that, because it started since then. So that's another reason why we're so enthused about getting this thing taken care of. You just get kind of a guilt feeling knowing that you were feeding poison to your friends and your children. That's the hardest part for me to take. You know, it's bad enough I know I've been drinking it, but my kids have been drinking it, my relatives have been drinking it, my family, my sisters, and their kids have been drinking it. So it's hard not to feel kind of responsible for it when they don't have PFAS in their water, but we do. So anything we can do to help get this problem solved, we're going to do it.
Recently, Governor Tony Evers and the head of the Wisconsin DNR visited French Island to get updates on the town's project for a new well and to hear from residents like Jim and Margie.
Governor went around, talked to individuals, introduced himself, and he was filled in on what was going to happen, you know, where the well was going to be and how they're going to do it and everything else. He was real concerned about it, I think. I think he's doing what a governor should as far as this PFAS things go. At least to me, it seems like it. Seems like a real dedicated guy, and he's talking about the budget and how we were going to fit this in. And anything that gets done positive about the PFAS thing, you got to feel good about, because they can't do nothing but get better. It can't get any worse. So all of his work and all of lay down his work and how many other people are working on it, it gives us peace of mind of a sort. You know, the problem isn't solved, but at least they got a time frame, you know, to where it could possibly happen at that time. I just hope we're around long enough to enjoy some more nice French Island water.
I was going to say that when we went to that meeting a couple weeks ago, everybody that was there talked about how great our water was. We loved the water on French Island, not knowing that it was contaminated. And then you go back into the city and you drink that horrible city water. You come back here and you have a really good well water. That's what we thought. And everybody there at that meeting said the same thing. Oh, we love our water. We loved our water.
That's what makes it so hard to take, is that, like she said, we loved our water. This water up here was better for one thing, damn it, chlorine or all the other stuff in it. But now, knowing that nice, precious water we had is poison, you know, that's pretty scary. We still, both of us still do it. We go to make a cup of coffee or get a drink of water. We go right over to the sink and go, oh. Little words are said, but I won't repeat them. Then we go back over to the cooler and get our water from there. And 2 days later, you might do the same thing. And this has been going on that long, and that's just a habit that you have throughout your whole life. And it's pretty hard to break it. You know, you just take water. Matter of fact, it's there all the time. So it's hard to adjust to.
Jim took us on a little tour of the house to see how their water is delivered and how it's set up.
Get them out of there like that. And then roll them over here like this. And disconnect that one off here. Put it on here. And move that one and slide the full one in. And then the empties, we can't keep them all in there because we want to use that floor space in there for something else. So I put the empties down in the basement, which is no big deal, but still they got to be moved around. But that's how I got to move them, just roll them in.
For Jim and Margie, not having clean tap water has changed what they eat.
I'm the cook here, and I've always ran in our family. We were all soup makers and stew makers and that kind of stuff. Well, the soup takes, you know, 90% of soup is water. I got a little freezer down in the basement that I just kept my soups and my stews and stuff in because I'd make a big pot of it, and then we'd separate it into meals. Well, I had probably 8 or 10, maybe, containers of it down in my freezer, and I brought it up and put a tarp out on the driveway and dumped them all right out on the highway and said, or on the driveway. I said, there's my soup now. That's what PFAS did for us. There must have been probably 20 meals in there or more. And I'll dump it out. I don't make soup anymore because of that. I got to take all the water out of that cooler, and it runs out like a little stream about a quarter of an inch. So I timed it. It takes 5 seconds to make a cup of coffee, to get enough water for a cup of coffee. Will you drink instant coffee? How much time would it take to fill up a kettle full for soup? So I just said, the heck with it. And I would still make chili and some other things, but I don't make soup anymore, no, for that reason.
I asked Margie about the biggest changes in her daily life when it comes to not being able to use her tap water.
I don't know what to say, because I am so used to it now. It's just an everyday thing. I'm just thankful that we have water. We have water delivered to us. We buy that water. And I just have to look at it that way, is that I'm grateful that we have water, because look at all the people that don't, the different countries and whatever else. I have to have a positive attitude about it. And right now it's been 4 years and I'm just used to it. Just used to it. People say, well, how's your water problem? How's your water problem? Well, we don't know when it's going to be taken care of. We don't know when we're going to be able to go in there and turn on the faucet. But now it's just an everyday thing. You just get used to it.
Occasionally I go to one of my best friends is a barber. And if you want to know what's going on, go into the barber shop. So there's about 4 or 5 of us guys that go down there and they're all talking about it, you know, the PFAS water. They just, when they come in, how's it going now? How's it going now? And I just keep saying, we're still waiting. We're still waiting.
For Jim and Margie, it's not just about drinking water from the tap or brushing their teeth. It's changed everything.
I've been fishing all around this island ever since I've lived up here. So if that water out there was contaminated, so were the fish. And we were eating them too. So we're getting a double whammy there. All the people I fished up here and then ate them. But there's just so many things that it involves. You know, it isn't just water, take a drink, and, you know, forget about it like you used to. Now it's every time water is mentioned, first thing we think about is PFAS. You know, so it's a part of our life now. Whether we get a new, even with the new water, that's not going to get rid of the effects that we got from the PFAS water. So we're stuck with it no matter what. for the rest of our lives. And like I said, I've got thyroid problems, and I think that came from that, and there's other people up here who have problems too. So it isn't something like, okay, we got your water fixed, everything's going to be great. It'll never end for most of us until we're gone. So, you know, you got to live with that. I don't know, it's a life-changing, no doubt about that. Our lifestyle isn't the same as it used to be. You know, I can't go down there and catch fish now feeling that they're safe to eat. When you think about water, well, you don't actually think about it every day. How often do you think about your water? Never. You know, it's just turn the tap on, it's automatically there. Not anymore. You got to go buy the bottles, or you got to order it from Culligan or whatever you got to do, you know. It's a little bit depressing when your dreams of this was going to be our place where we were going to, you know, live as long as we could. And this water thing just kind of put a kink in it. But we're going to stay here as long as we can anyway, even if we got to drink bottled water all the time until this is all done. Hopefully we've got several years ahead of us yet. You know, I'm 83 and you're 70. Yeah?
I'm 78.
Eight. Yeah. I was going to say that, but I thought I'd probably be wrong.
The municipality where Jim and Margie live is officially called the Town of Campbell. But local officials are petitioning to become a village that operates its own municipal water system, with French Island as their new official name. I asked Margie what she thought about this plan.
We didn't really know that this area was anything other than French Island. We didn't even know about Town of Campbell, Town of Shelby, Town of Madary. Never paid any attention to that until, you know, we're here for a while and now we're paying taxes and it's the Town of Campbell. Oh, we live in the Town of Campbell? Oh, I thought we just French Island, you know, French Island. But it's just, and do you know why it's called an island? Because we're surrounded by water. You can only get here by taking bridges to get here. And the French part comes from the French people, the Olivets and Jolivets and a bunch of other French people, but those are the ones. But yeah, everyone would say, how did you get that name, French Island? Well, the name and the island.
Most of the, we always just call it the island.
Yeah, the island.
Where do you live, up on the island?
Up on the island. Not the Paradise Island, but, you know, it's
whatever. Oh, it was. It was every morning I got up and went fishing. It was paradise. French Island water was lovely.
It was.
Yeah.
It was.
For Wisconsin Today, I'm Rochelle Wilson.
And that is Jim Boyson and Margie Walker, who live on French Island and have been relying on bottled water since December of 2020 due to PFAS contamination while the community awaits a permanent source of clean drinking water.
This story was produced by Rochelle Wilson with technical direction from Sarah Hopeful.
We've noticed the surge in retail boycotts recently in response to big companies pulling back on their diversity initiatives.
Some consumers are taking action with their wallets against major retailers like Amazon and Target, and in the coming weeks, boycotts of Nestle and Walmart are planned.
As we look ahead to discussions about these organized boycotts, we want to know, have you stopped buying from a certain store or avoided a brand before? What was your reason behind the change in your purchasing habits, and how do you feel like you made an impact?
Tell us about your feelings toward economic boycotts, past and present. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
And thanks for being a part of Wisconsin Today.
We Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Lee Rayburn.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.